Timothy Michael Baird versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hayden and Ms. Darren. You can conveniently remain seated. Next argument. No. Just making a lighthearted point. Mr. Hayden, do you need rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to preserve 5 minutes.
All right. You have it. I'd be happy to hear from you.
May it please the Court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Timothy Michael Baird, who was convicted in a jury trial in the Hampton Circuit Court of 2 counts of use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, received an active sentence of 5 years in prison. We've assigned as error that the trial court erred in refusing to declare a mistrial where damaging but inadmissible testimony concerning the presence of gunshot residue on Baird's hands could not be rectified by a mere curative instruction. We would submit that once that bell had been rung, it could not be unrung.
Was the mistrial motion timely made?
Yes, absolutely. It was done right at during the course of the trial, and shortly after the judge...
Well, the criteria isn't during the course of a trial. The criteria is it has to be made when whatever objectionable testimony is presented. Isn't that right?
No. What happened here was there was extensive testimony given. It runs on for about 50 pages of testimony from this expert, the science lab expert Zitrovich, and also from the detective about the presence of gunshot residue. At the end of all that, this about 50 pages of testimony, then the judge rules, well, they failed to establish chain of custody, they failed to allow this evidence, it's inadmissible. And proceeded to exclude the evidence of regarding the gunshot residue, and then once that happened,
but there was no motion for mistrial at that point. The Commonwealth then rested. The defense did what it was going to do. Rested, made the motion to strike, lost the motion to strike, and only after losing the motion to strike made the motion for a mistrial. Correct.
That is correct.
Are you allowed to wait until after your dispositive motion is denied to say, oh, by the way, I'd like a mistrial?
It was done before the jury returns a verdict. Before it certainly was not a situation where it prejudiced the Commonwealth to any delay in response. It's still the same dynamic.
Is there any law that says that the Commonwealth has to be prejudiced?
Well, no, there is not. But, of course, it is only human and natural that a person doesn't immediately recognize that there is this issue of the mistrial. It took a few moments for the trial counsel to make an assessment. Well, is this curative instruction really sufficient that the judge gave? And it took her some short time to make a to sort of resolve the matter in her mind and make the objection.
Time to argue the motion to strike and wait for a result.
Well, I think it's somewhat unreasonable to require the trial counsel to immediately recognize the issue and be able to say...
That's precisely what the rules of procedural default require.
Well... I would respectfully submit that it was...
I'm not saying that's easy, but those are the rules.
I would respectfully submit that she did it timely enough. There has to be the request for curative instruction. She can't immediately make the request for a mistrial prior to the attempt to give a curative instruction. That had to be done first. That was done. It's only if she'd made the mistrial right at the moment he excludes the evidence, it would have been premature, right? Because you have to first attempt to see, is it possible...
Well, couldn't she say that They failed to establish the chain of custody. There's no way to unring this bell. Therefore, I move for a mistrial. Alternatively, judge, a curative instruction.
I believe the case law requires that there first be an attempt to rectify the problem with a curative instruction. And that was done. That was the first resort. But then after considering this, she ultimately concludes, well, really the curative instruction won't do the trick. It won't unring the bell. It will be...
Why doesn't the curative instruction unring the bell? I mean, the model jury instructions, of course, have a standard instruction. You shall not consider any evidence that has been stricken.
Well, where the prejudicial but inadmissible evidence creates a manifest necessity to discharge the jury in a mistrial because the error is so impressive that it probably remained on the minds of a jury and influenced the verdict. That's the standard. If this was such a serious error, then it's recognized this is just simply too prejudicial. This was the only this evidence of gunshot residue on his hand that was inadmissible evidence, and no chain of custody. It's in the juror's minds. He has gunshot residue on his hands. He probably fired a gun. He therefore must be guilty. And they're not going to disregard it because of some legal nicety of the judge.
But don't we start with the presumption that they did follow and obey the they listened to and obeyed the instruction?
Right. We start with that presumption, but that's a rebuttable presumption. It can be overcome. Where the effect of the evidence is so impressive that it probably remained on the minds of the jury and influenced the verdict, that means there's a manifest necessity to discharge the jury in a mistrial. And that's precisely what we're arguing here is there was minimal evidence. Supposedly he's supposed to have fired this gun at point blank range 5 or 6 feet away at this other car and somehow misses the car entirely. There's no firearm found. There's no ballistics found. If somehow he misses this huge target 5 feet away from this entire car somehow. But we do the only thing that really solidly happened. Well, there's this gunshot residue on his hand. He must have fired something.
How about the eyewitness testimony of the passenger that she saw him pull the trigger, saw the muzzle flash, saw him fire the gun after his statement that I'm going to blank and kill you?
That's what she claimed. There was a cite in the brief for the reasons why that testimony ought to have been distrusted and doubted. We would submit, I've made the argument for the sufficiency, but that's not what I want to focus on today in the oral argument. I think the key issue is the fact that it wasn't just a single reference to gunshot residue. It wasn't just a passing aside, and the judge said, disregard that. It's roughly 50 pages of testimony. I mean, they went on for a long time discussing this the gunshot, and this expert, this Mitrovich lady testifying from the state lab, is testifying at length about the presence of the gunshot residue. And they can't ignore it at that point when it's been taken up such a large portion of the trial and the transcript before the judge finally reaches the conclusion, I don't think I really tied it up.
Didn't trial counsel argue in opening about the GSR testing?
I honestly don't recollect that. I don't know. It might, if you, the court sees it there, then I accept the court's proffer.
I
will assume that. But
and the expert never testified that this defendant fired the gun.
All right. I didn't certainly did not. I was not focused on that part of the transcript. I haven't reread the beginning of the transcript. I was focusing on the part where the objections made.
And wasn't there a cross-examination about other theories, how one particle of the residue could have ended up on the glove?
Yes, that's certainly true. I would just note that if he did, and assuming he did, based on the court's representation, whatever he said in the opening statement is the jurors are still admonished. Whatever you hear in the opening statement is not evidence. It's not
as they are admonished that anything that the court strikes is not evidence. But you tell me we can't rely on them to follow that instruction.
Right, and so he's discussing what he is. He apparently is expecting that that they will be able to tie up the evidence, and he's simply describing what he thinks. But they are told don't consider it as evidence until you actually hear it from the stand. Then they do hear it from the stand at length for an exhaustive period. Then he and finally, after all that, the judge says. It strikes the evidence, gives them the warning to disregard it, but then I believe I'm used up my time. I'm going to defer and
okay, you roughly at your rebuttal time. All right, thank you.
Good morning again. It is the court, Leah Barron, for the Commonwealth. In this particular case, opposing counsel has limited his argument to the second issue, which is the motion for a mistrial issue. I don't think we can divorce this particular procedural issue, if you will, from the facts of the case. This is an awful, terrible case of road rage where one car was driving slow. That's the car where the victims occupied, and the car in which the defendant was the backseat passenger pulled alongside. There was yelling. The defendant pulled a gun, according to the both passengers of the car, the defendant pulled a gun. He threatened to kill the occupants of the other vehicle. The girlfriend, who was the front seat passenger, said she looked this defendant straight in the eye.
The sufficiency argument is one of credibility, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the fact finder believes Sarah's testimony, there's nothing else to talk about, is there?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. All right, so I will move on then to the motion for a mistrial, and that is the first part of that argument is our argument that there was a waiver of the mistrial issue. There was an objection to the admissibility of the expert firearm experts gunshot residue test based on chain of custody, and the court pages 226 through 227 of the appendix record indicated that he would exclude that testimony and that a cautionary instruction would be given to the jury. At this point, the defense counsel had everything necessary that she needed in order to not only ask that the evidence be stricken, but that the court grant a mistrial on that basis. And thereafter, after the court ruled, indicated he was going to give an instruction, a cautionary instruction to the jury to disregard. The court specifically asked defense counsel at page 229 of the appendix record whether she had any additional motions, and counsel responded no, that she would after the Commonwealth rested. Thereafter, the defense argues their motion to strike, and which was at pages 229 through 238 of the record, and only after thereafter at page 240 of the appendix record was there a motion for a mistrial based on the gunshot residue testimony? I think I said that was at page 240. And it is our position that when the issue came up at page 226 through 227 of the appendix record, that it was at that point that counsel had a duty to make the mistrial motion and not waiting for some length of time after arguments had been made at page 240 of the record to make that motion for a mistrial. So under our position is under Rule 5A18, that motion was waived The case law on this, particularly Yates in the Virginia Supreme Court, is very clear on this issue. We've also gone ahead and argued that even if the motion were timely, a mistrial was not warranted under the facts of this case. As one of the court has pointed out, that the expert gave no opinion that the defendant had fired a weapon. Her testimony simply was that there was one particle of primer residue on the defendant's hand. And basically, for the reasons that the trial judge excluded this evidence are the reasons why a mistrial is not warranted. The arresting officer did not follow proper procedures when he took this gunshot residue test. He had admitted that he had handled his own service weapon prior to taking the test. So there was evidence that the particle could have transferred at that from him to the defendant while he was placing him under arrest and putting him in handcuffs and putting him in the back of the police car. There was testimony that the particle could have come from the table at which the defendant sat during the interview.
But none of those seemed all that plausible.
Well, it's our position.
I mean, like, for example, the officer talked about how he thoroughly cleaned the service weapon, et cetera, et cetera. So while there's an abstract possibility that when he recertified on his gun training months before, cleaned his weapon, that's nevertheless a particle was still hanging around, it just doesn't seem very
likely. Think the very fact that it was a single particle found on his hand, it's not a number of particles that you might expect would be on the defendant's hand after he recently fired a weapon. And also, again, the expert did not have an opinion that the defendant had fired a weapon.
Could he have?
Any number of...
Wouldn't that invade the ultimate issue?
She probably could not have said it quite that way. But nevertheless, this is not the type of testimony that is so prejudicial that it could not have been cured by a prompt cautionary instruction, which was given to the jurors in this case and which the jury is presumed to have followed. So I'd also like to point out that really the issue on as Judge Frank pointed out, we've got the identification of this defendant as the person pulling the weapon. The issue in this case is whether he, as other counsel has argued on brief, is whether he shot into the vehicle because there was no, obviously it was a clean through and through the vehicle shot, which is pretty quieter, Wild Wild West stuff to think that somebody could not have been hit by that, or the vehicle could not have been hit by that.
You know, the window testimony was the windows were down.
Those windows were down. Thank goodness for that. But at any rate, the issue was really whether he shot at the vehicle or perhaps shot into the air. And
if we find that the unringing of the bell was impossible, even though there was plenty of other evidence on which to convict, wouldn't we have to reverse?
Your Honor, I just would urge the court to take a look at the cases in footnote 1 of our brief. Where on appeal the courts have found a mistrial was warranted after a cautionary instruction had been given and a timely motion for a mistrial has been requested are situations where those situations are rare, number one, and number two, there are situations where there's just extremely inflammatory and irrelevant evidence that's presented by the witness's testimony. And we've cited Mills, which is in 24 Virginia App, in our brief, and in that particular situation, the state trooper comment, it was irrelevant and improper regarding needle marks on the defendant's arm. We've also cited a Virginia Supreme Court case. I think if you compare the facts of this case with the facts of the of those very rare circumstances where the court has found a mistrial should have been granted, the court should reach the conclusion that the cautionary instruction given to the jury in this case is adequate. Are there any further questions?
Thank you very much for
the court to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Hayden, any rebuttal?
Very briefly, regarding the timeliness of the objection, I would just note that the objections made, and we're talking about on pages 227, 228, the judge says he's going to do the curative instruction, and he notes the exception on 229. He says, now, Ms. O'Brien, do you have any other motions you wish to make before we bring the jury back? She says, no, Your Honor. Immediately after that, Commonwealth says, we rest. And then Judge, well, then I do have a motion to strike. She makes the argument of the motion to strike. Immediately after the motion to strike is denied, that's when she makes it. There was no new evidence that's presented during this time frame. It's just simply it takes a few moments for her to register. Well, is this curative instruction really going to be sufficient to rectify the problem? There's been no additional evidence presented.
An alternative, quite reasonable interpretation of the way the events presented was she decided to roll the dice and see if she was going to win on the motion to strike so that her client wouldn't have to sit through another trial, and only when she lost did she ask for a new trial.
Well, I suppose it is possible that that could have been the reason, but it might. I suppose it's possible, but I can't go into her mind, but certainly the fact that it was not a situation where there was additional evidence that was presented and she let the trial roll on for a time before she makes her objection. The only thing that happens is she makes the initial argument that she has in mind about the motion to strike, and then upon reflection simply realize, well, I really need to make this request for a mistrial because of the lack of cautionary, because the cautionary instruction won't remove this evidence. The jurors' minds have been tainted, contaminated by the improper evidence. They're going to infer from this evidence that he was probably guilty of firing a firearm, and that an inference was unlikely to be rectified by curative instruction. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. We'll greet counsel and take the next case.